You expect from this kind of ambassador from the new Trump administration?
So obviously, Trump appointments and Trump policies are terrifying to us, and should be to anyone who cares about the rights of Palestinians. I do want to also point out, however, Trump policies have an inherent contradiction. As an isolationist, Trump does not want to get involved in too many wars. As someone who wants to break deals with Saudi Arabia and Arab Gulf states, he may want to ensure that they don't drift into the Iran-China field of influence. And those two policies, being pro-annexation and pro-settlements and pro-Israel, and being pro-war and wanting to sign deals, they collide. And I think it's our role on the left to kind of put a wedge in there and try and make sure that it becomes more and more apparent how those policies conflict with each other.
Hagai Matar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of Plus 972 magazine, former conscientious objector, refused to serve in the Israeli army. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Emily Goslin. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Anna Elias, Dennis Moynihan, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, going now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than by giving your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the second longest teacher strike in Oregon history is over, Governor Tina Kotek proposes her new budget, and in international news, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol announced he would lift a martial law order just hours after he declared it. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 3rd, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eliza Yurkov. The teacher strike in Albany officially ended today. The Greater Albany Education Association and Greater Albany Public Schools finally came to an agreement after more than 9 months of negotiations and 3 weeks of striking. The strike started on November 12th when the school district would not meet the union's demands of increased prep time and implementing safety protocols. The strike almost ended this weekend, but the deal fell through when the school district proposed a return-to-work agreement last minute. The union and school district could not agree on whether teachers should be paid for the days they were striking and how many makeup days could be added in the school year or summer. Last night at 8:30 p.m., they finalized a new labor and return to work agreement that will last until 2027. Union officials say the new labor agreement includes many improvements like new safety protocols, smaller classroom sizes, and increased support for students with learning differences. Teachers pledged to return to class this morning, though school started 2 hours later than usual. This was the first time in 40 years that Albany teachers went on strike, and it was the second longest teacher strike in Oregon history. Governor Tina Kotek unveiled her recommended 2-year budget yesterday. The three core issues she wants the legislature to address are housing, education, and mental health. Lawmakers will convene in January for a 6-month session, and the budget is one of the priorities. It calls for $138 billion, a 13% increase from the 2023 budget. She says it's a, quote, stability budget, where she neither cut services or proposed major new programs or large service increases. She's also calling for a special session on December 12th to give over $200 million to the Department of Forestry for the unprecedented costs of this year's wildfire season. In the 2025 budget, she wants to move $150 million from the Rainy Day Fund to ODF and the Office of State Fire Marshal to address those ongoing costs. The governor's proposal fails to include where the money would be coming from. Republicans foreshadow political fights that will most likely dominate the upcoming session. Senate Republican leader Daniel Bonham says, quote, more government spending and bureaucracy won't fix Oregon's housing crisis, homelessness epidemic, healthcare affordability, or students' success. It'll make these issues worse, end quote. Among the billions of dollars she plans to allocate to housing and mental health, Kotek proposes increasing the school budget by 10% from $10 to $11 billion. In 2023, Portland public school teachers went on strike for almost 2 weeks because the budget did not fully cover their contract demands. The governor, like Democratic executives around the country, is also proposing money that might temper the potential impacts of President-elect Donald Trump's impending second term. Beyond her three big issues, Kotek plans to battle climate change and invigorate the State Department of Justice. An itemized list of her budget proposal can be found on OPB's website. South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law late Tuesday night, the first time it had been called in nearly 50 years. About 5 hours later, he lifted it. South Korea became a parliamentary democracy in 1987, ending its long-term dictatorship. The last time a martial law was declared was in 1980 during a nationwide uprising led by students and labor unions. Yoon Suk-yeol won the presidency in 2022 as a hardline conservative. He has been a lame duck president since April when the opposition won the general election. Since then, he hasn't been able to pass bills and has seen a fall in his approval ratings, hovering around 17%. This week, the opposition proposed slashing a major government budget bill that cannot be vetoed. It also moved to impeach cabinet members and top prosecutors for failing to investigate the First Lady. She has been mired in several corruption scandals this year, including stock manipulation and accepting bribes. Yoon called for the martial law, saying the opposition was working with North Korea to threaten the country's democracy. Almost immediately, citizens took to the streets in protest and lawmakers voted to block the decree. Senior DP member of parliament Park Chan-dae said in a statement, quote, even if martial law is lifted, he cannot avoid treason charges. It was clearly revealed to the entire nation that President Yoon could no longer run the country normally. He should step down, end quote. Multnomah County Commissioner-elect Shannon Singleton has taken her seat on the county board early. Singleton was elected on November 5th and was sworn in today after the election results were certified Monday. The County District 2 seat was vacated by Commissioner Sushila Jayapal earlier this spring to run for federal office. Then, Interim Commissioner Jesse Beeson was serving in place until someone new was elected. Singleton beat opponent Sam Adams by 15 points in the November election. She's had a career in homeless services and in multiple levels of government, including Portland, Multnomah County, and the governor's office. Here are some of her remarks at her swearing in earlier today.
I'm just so excited. This is a little bit overwhelming. And I just want to tell you that growing up in the Philly area, this was never something that I imagined would happen. After a couple of decades of working in housing and human services in the Portland area, I really got tired of hearing politicians give reasons why they wouldn't do something right. And I decided instead of being mad at them, I would join them. And so I reached out to a friend and asked about what it's like to work in a political office. I had been the executive director at JOIN, where if folks know anything about homelessness, everything is political around homelessness. So I was around politics, but never on the inside. And that's where I had an opportunity to work for Governor Kate Brown, where I was initially her housing advisor and went on to be her director of equity and racial justice. And I can tell you it was very different on the inside. We were working through the pandemic. We were working through wildfires. We were working through Donald Trump. We were mourning George Floyd and trying to find reason in this world. It was hard, but it taught me a lot. It taught me that if you want to change the world, you have to start at home. You have to put your ego aside and admit that you might be wrong. You have to recognize that your neighbors might be on the other side of politics, but they're still the people with two little kids who lose their basketball on the street every week. And if you can set aside politics, you can have a damn good time watching the game with each other. We don't have to agree about everything to agree on one thing. We love this place. And if we can get there, we can get anywhere. You know, Commissioner Beeson called me after the election with some bad news. Because I was filling a vacancy, I had to start on December 2nd. That was good news for him, by the way. And I'll tell you, it's been a whirlwind wrapping up a career and staffing a new office in the matter of a couple of weeks. I wouldn't recommend it, but then again, maybe I would. Because I'm taking a seat here with four incredibly talented women who are dedicated to serving the place they love and who have welcomed me so warmly. And if you have to hustle a little bit to take a seat like that, you probably should. And you know what? I'm just kidding. I was ready last week. Now let's get some stuff done. Thank you.
That was newly sworn in Multnomah County Commissioner Shannon Singleton speaking at her early swearing-in ceremony today. Her term runs through December of next year. President-elect Trump's pick to lead the FBI says he'll eradicate the, quote, deep state. Democrats say President Biden's pardon of his son could haunt them, and new allegations surface regarding the man Trump has tapped to lead the Pentagon. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you.
Former federal prosecutor Kash Patel says he'll charge those who conspired against President-elect Donald Trump should he win confirmation to lead the FBI. A longtime Trump ally, Patel has vowed to eradicate what he calls the deep state, but observers note some Republican senators may oppose replacing current FBI Director Christopher Wray, who Trump nominated in 2017. Democrats are warning about the ramifications of President Joe Biden pardoning his son Hunter. Maryland Congressman Glenn Ivey says the decision is hard to defend.
I know that there was a real strong sentiment wanting to protect Hunter Biden from unfair prosecution, but this is going to be used against us when we're fighting the misuses that are coming from the Trump administration.
President Biden long vowed not to pardon his son, who faced gun and tax charges stemming from a time of drug addiction. Meanwhile, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is asking Biden to grant clemency to thousands of Americans serving time in federal prisons, including the elderly and chronically ill. She points to the much harsher sentences for crack than powder cocaine and marijuana convictions in places where it's now legal.
People with unjustified sentencing disparities like crack cocaine disparities, and even those who don't benefit from new laws due to lack of retroactive clauses.
Pressley says Biden has a chance to free thousands who pose no threat but are still rotting in prison because of mass incarceration. Republicans are rejecting new allegations of public drunkenness and sexual misconduct against Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, Fox News host Pete Hegseth has admitted to paying a woman to end charges of sexual assault. Now the New Yorker reports whistleblower accusations forced him to resign from leading two nonprofits. Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville says he doesn't believe the allegations, and Hegseth still has his vote.
We need a drill sergeant in the military. We need somebody to straighten the military out, to get the woke, the DEI affiliation out, and go from there.
Meanwhile, outgoing Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is urging his successor, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, to fully vet all of Trump's nominees.
The best mechanism for ensuring the president appoints qualified, capable, and ethical officials is precisely the advise and consent power of the Senate.
Trump has called for use of so-called recess appointments to bypass the Senate. Thune has called that an option. And California state lawmakers began a special legislative session to codify some progressive policies before next year. The state is also pledging to resist mass migrant deportations. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any point during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for news in depth. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Tonight's weather will be cold and clear with a low of 33 degrees. And tomorrow, it will be more of the same chilly, clear skies, getting up to a sweltering 45 degrees. Today in history, put your phone down. In 1992, Neil Papworth sent the first SMS, short message service, text message in history to the phone of a colleague. It read, "Merry Christmas." A year later, Nokia released the first cell phone with an SMS feature limited to 160 characters. The quote of the day is from author and poet Jo Harjo. In her collection of poems titled The Woman Who Fell from the Sky, she writes, quote, "It's possible to understand the world from studying a leaf. You can comprehend the laws of aerodynamics, mathematics, poetry, and biology through the complex beauty of such a perfect structure. It is also possible to travel the whole globe and learn nothing." Native American tribes are concerned about the impacts the Trump administration will have on the environment. Tribes and environmental advocates are urging President Biden to do even more to protect public lands. And a new report shows indigenous-owned businesses contribute billions of dollars to the U.S. economy each year. With those stories and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. With a second Trump term near, Native American tribes are concerned for environmental restoration efforts. In his first presidential term, Donald Trump opened up lands considered sacred to Native people for development, as well as rolling back dozens of environmental protections. In a press call of tribal officials last month, Oregon Governor Tina Kotick said she'll stand with Oregon values as the White House changes hands again.
My hope is we will see respect and cooperation from the federal administration to work with our tribes.
Kotick says she's focused on the Columbia Basin Initiative, which has worked with President Joe Biden to restore fish runs. William Ray Jr., chair of the Klamath Tribes, then spoke about protecting salmon and two species of sucker fish.
Our biggest concerns about the incoming administration is the water delivery systems and how it's going to affect our endangered species of Tuam and Coptu mullet species. If all the water delivery agreements are fulfilled at 100%, extinction becomes real viable.
Trump has discussed diverting water from the Columbia River to California and has also questioned the need for protecting the endangered Delta smelt there. President Biden has created more national monuments in a single term than any president since Jimmy Carter left office in 1981. Tribes and environmental advocates are pressing him to do even more. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports.
After President Donald Trump shrunk the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante monuments in Utah, Biden's first step was restoring them.
And because of that, he really started thinking about monuments right from the get-go. So you see much more activity than you see usually during the first term.
Justin Padeau is a professor at the University of Arizona Law School who worked in the Biden and Obama administrations. He says Biden has had a particular focus on monuments proposed by tribes. That includes Avikwame, established last year in Nevada. It's a site sacred to the Fort Mojave Indian tribe, among others. Before leaving the White House, Biden could designate more national monuments. Local campaigns are advocating for protection of the Owyhee Canyon lands on the border of Oregon and Idaho, and the Dolores Canyons in southwest Colorado. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
A new report reveals indigenous-owned businesses contribute more than $46 billion to the U.S. economy each year. And a lot of that activity is happening in the West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Research firm B2B Reviews analyzed the percentage of indigenous-owned businesses within each state and how many people they employ, among other factors. Researchers found that Oregon is the best state in the country for indigenous entrepreneurs. Nevada, Idaho, Washington, and New Mexico also cracked the top 10. Arizona and California made the top 20. Colorado and Montana landed in the middle of the rankings, and Wyoming and Utah were near the bottom. Zach Carman is a member of the Kaw Tribe and CEO of Consumer Affairs, a national user review website. He says indigenous business owners face many challenges that politicians should address.
Oftentimes, state and federal are just completely disconnected from the realities of indigenous peoples. I think you would need to start by listening and building resources and programs that fit their reality.
He says that could help indigenous entrepreneurs gain more access to funding, business education, and mentorship. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
And 35 years ago, President George H.W. Bush proclaimed the week of December 3rd through the 9th as National American Indian Heritage Week, as Presidents Reagan and Ford had done in their terms. But the following year, Bush would approve a joint resolution making November 1990 the first National American Indian Heritage Month. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
All Multnomah County libraries will have the same open hours starting this month. On Mondays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, county libraries are open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. On Tuesdays and Wednesdays, the libraries are open from noon to 8 p.m. On Sundays, the libraries are open from noon to 6 p.m. It's the first big update to library hours in over a decade. Library officials say it's to help balance enough regular and safety staff and help library workers balance their other duties. They won't be cutting budgets, staff, hours, or pay. Annie Lewis is the director of libraries. Lewis said, quote, "The library is trying to balance the needs and wishes of families, working people, and others by offering morning and evening hours on different days across Multnomah County," end quote. Up-to-date information on library hours, including any changes from inclement weather, can be found on their website, multcolib.org. Sir Elton John shocked the world recently when he revealed he's lost his eyesight and was unable to even see the stage of his new musical, The Devil Wears Prada. The singer appeared at the premiere but left early and was led out of the theater by husband David Furnish. Sir John had already revealed that he was blind in his right eye, secondary to an infection. However, the 77-year-old performer added his eyesight has worsened, leaving him unable to see the performance of the show for which he wrote the music. Sir John has said he's been struggling to be productive. He dates the loss of his sight in his right eye to July, when he experienced an infection in the south of France. He said on Good Morning America, quote, "It's been a while since I've done anything. I just have to get off my backside. It kind of floored me, and I can't see anything. I can't read anything. I can't watch anything," end quote. He made an onstage speech at a star-studded charity gala for the Elton John AIDS Foundation at the Dominion Theatre in London's West End. He said, quote, "As some of you know, I have had issues, and now I have lost my sight. I haven't been able to see the performance, but I have enjoyed it," end quote. He added, quote, "It's hard for me to see it, but I love to hear it, and it sounded good tonight. Thank you for coming," end quote. Donald Trump's penchant for deal-making will be sorely tested when it comes to China. Beijing is appealing for, quote, cooperation and coordination based on mutual respect and win-win projects, but Trump is again threatening a trade war. The two sides are headed for renewed confrontation. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On November 7, Xi Jinping sent a congratulatory message to President-elect Trump that said, quote, a stable, healthy, sustainably developing China-U.S. relationship fits with the common interests of the two countries and with the expectations of international society. I hope the two sides will keep to the principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, strengthen channels of dialogue, improve control over differences, expand mutually beneficial cooperation, and move down the road of correctly getting along in a new period with prosperity for both countries and benefits to the world, unquote. Subsequently, other Chinese sources, as well as Xi himself, in a conversation with President Biden, repeated this line of thought. China wants more rather than less cooperation with the United States. Other Chinese sources chimed in. One commentary cited achievements of China-U.S. cooperation in diplomacy, finance, climate change, and military-to-military communication. Thus, said this writer, whether promoting world economic recovery or resolving international and regional hotspot issues, China-U.S. coordination and cooperation are needed. Coordination and cooperation are very unlikely to be realized, however, because of probably insuperable obstacles each country has set. The second Trump administration will not merely reject engagement, as Biden's did. This time around, relations with China will be on a much steeper slope. Under Trump, we will no longer hear about managing relations or looking for shared interests. U.S. officials are unlikely to repeat promises to China to uphold the One China policy and not seek to change China's system. Stabilizing the U.S.-China relationship, which drew praise from Xi at his final meeting with Biden, will no longer be important to Washington. There are several already clear reasons for this conclusion. Trump's announced determination to impose very high tariffs on Chinese goods, his appointment of China hawks to key national security positions, the bipartisan hostility toward China in Congress, China's high unfavorable rating in American public opinion, and the advice Trump has received from previous appointees in the Project 2025 report. Moreover, Trump, unlike Biden, will not be distracted from his China policy by overseas conflicts. As for China, the emphasis on points of actual and potential collaboration with the U.S. is just one piece of its America policy. Xi qualifies cooperation in important ways by saying that the U.S. must have a correct strategic perception of China, must adhere to the three principles mentioned in Xi's message to Trump, namely mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, and must choose between partnership or rivalry. Those qualifications aim at specific elements of U.S. policy, security alliances directed at the China threat, military and political support of Taiwan, and denial of semiconductor and other high-tech exports to China. U.S. presidents, Donald Trump least of all, have not been moved by appeals to principle, nor have they been open to correcting their perceptions of China to suit Beijing. Nevertheless, it is worth examining where room for a China-U.S. deal might exist. What might a good return on investment look like to Trump? Since his priority is trade, he would aim at a major increase in Chinese purchases of U.S. goods to reduce the trade deficit, even though that didn't work the first time around, and improve conditions for U.S. investments, all while retaining sharp restrictions on advanced technology exports to China. In return, Trump might be willing to lower U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports. He also might induce Xi by promising to reduce U.S. arms aid and high-level visits to Taiwan, though he might get pushback from strongly pro-Taiwan officials such as Marco Rubio, nominated for Secretary of State, and Mike Waltz, nominated for National Security Advisor. We're at a point in U.S.-China relations where deal-making is going to be very difficult, even in the best of circumstances. Mutual trust is very low, and once Trump takes over, initiatives to get along, as the Chinese say, will not be offered. Consequently, it will not take much to derail diplomacy altogether, as happened after the spy balloon incident in February 2023, and last month when China rejected a meeting between defense ministers because, China said, of a U.S. arms sale to Taiwan. Chinese proposals for deeper cooperation will be used to demonstrate that they are the reasonable party and that the Americans are as unpredictable as they are untrustworthy. And China will use that argument to try driving a wedge between the U.S. and its allies in the European Union and East Asia. We're in for a very cold war. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Mel Gertov, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. A special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, and Crystal Blair. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. There is a growing movement to end the U.S. economic blockade on Cuba and remove Cuba from the U.S. state sponsors on terrorism list. Protests have been held about those issues in the weeks leading up to the U.N. General Assembly vote on ending the U.S. blockade. Diana Block is with the Bay Area Cuba Solidarity Network. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg before the General Assembly vote about the blockade and Cuba's overall